Hello, I'm Jen in the marketing department. This interview is between best-selling author Stephen Baxter and his editor Marcus Gibbs. They're talking about the brand new sequel to The War of the Worlds, authorized by the H.G. Wells estate, that is out on the 19th of January. It's called The Massacre of Mankind. And they will be talking about Wells, the legacy of Wells, The War of the Worlds, and I'm not sure what else because I didn't do this interview, but I'm sure it will be amazing. Listen up.
Thank you, Steve, for coming in to talk to us about various projects that you have with Gallants and with other publishers over the next few months and years. I thought we'd start off by talking about The Massacre of Mankind, which is your sequel, of course, to H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about how the idea for doing a sequel came to you and what were the complications in working on such a beloved text.
I suppose the idea, in a way, goes back 20 years or more, back to when I did a sequel to The Time Machine.
Yes, The Time Ships.
The Time Ships, yeah, published in 1995, which was the 100th anniversary of that book. I'd always had in the back of my mind that The Time Machine ends on a very open point where the traveller goes off for a second journey into time, never comes back, and you're left with this question of what happens. In fact, as a kid, I thought there must be sequels out there. The further adventures of the time traveller, like John Carter of Mars, you know.
Were there unofficial ones? I know there were unofficial War of the Worlds.
Oh, there's been masses over the years, yeah. More for War of the Worlds. But no, there was no sequel by Wells. But as the anniversary was approaching, it occurred to me to have a go at a sequel. Myself. And at the time, I was kind of inspired to do more Wellesian sequels because I did very well. You know, got won awards. And the Wellesian community embraced it as well.
Were you a part of that community beforehand, or was that your entrance into it?
That was my entrance. There was there's a Wells Society, which is academic, basically. And it's been going since around 1960, when Wells's reputation, he's never been less than cherished by the science fiction community. But his reputation with the literary critics and so on has waxed and waned. But he was kind of rediscovered in 1960, and this World Society has been there ever since. And they had a seminar on the time machine in Imperial College, where Wells studied. And so I turned up and gave a paper on my sequel and other sequels by other hands, as you mentioned. And it was terrific. It was very well received. Brian Aldiss was there.
Fantastic.
Michael Foot was there.
Was he a fan, presumably, of the political stuff?
Yes, that's how he was drawn to Wells. He's one of the few people I've ever met who met Wells himself.
Wow.
He was the editor of the Evening Standard before the war, and Wells was doing think pieces for the Standard then. So to him, Wells was a very vivid, living figure. And he's the last person to know Wells who did a biography of Wells, as far as I know. So I think that's important. You know, you get a sense of the actual person in the world.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And how old would Michael Foot have been at the time?
Oh, well, pretty elderly. He did a biography of Wells himself a few years later. But how old was he when he died? Not long before he died. I think Wells, you see, in his day, was kind of like Paul McCartney now. You know, he's still in the world in his 70s, still functioning, still performing with this fantastic back catalogue. Instead of Sergeant Pepper, Wells had the Time Machine,
yes.
You know. But he was this big, vivid figure. And if you're not in the world with him, you can't really write, I don't think, a biography that does him justice in that way.
And so at the time, after The Time Machine, you were thinking of potentially other sequels?
Well, I was. I had this vague idea of following the centenaries through.
That's
1997
so nice.
Would have been 100 years of the War of the Worlds. But I thought, well, that's for me, that's a bit of a dead end in a way, because I had my own books to write.
Yes. You know,
so. Put it aside. But now this year, it's been Wells' 150th birthday, so I knew that was coming up. And Malcolm Edwards, of course, the great guru of Gallants, had this in the back of his mind as well. So that it all came together as very opportune.
And your previous experience led to the H.G. Wells estate granting authorization to the sequel, which is something they didn't need to do, as the book is going out of copyright shortly, but
yep.
It's a wonderful thing for us to have.
It is, well, but they authorized The Time Machine back in the day when it did need authorizations. There had been plenty of unauthorized sequels to Wells's books, but they authorized that one. It was the first official authorized sequel to The Time Machine, which is pretty good. And one of the nicest letters I've ever had about a book was from their lawyers.
Oh.
Yes, we sue, grab it and run. We agree that this is a suitable homage to Wells and so forth.
Fantastic.
So it should have been on the cover.
We can put it on the next one. You've collaborated with various authors, Arthur C. Clarke, Terry Pratchett, Alistair Reynolds. How is it different when you're in essence, collaborating with somebody who you can't bounce ideas off, you can't talk to?
I think there are a lot of similarities, actually. I think the best way to collaborate is to... the work gets divided between the two collaborators in some way. And so you've got a piece to work on, some chapter or a passage that you're going to think about. And I think the way to do it is to think about how the other guy would do it.
Mm.
How would Terry have approached this scene? How would Al have approached this scene? How would Clark approach this scene? And it never comes out that way, but that gets you into a sympathetic mode of thinking, if you see what I mean.
Yes, that's interesting. It gives you an insight into what do you think they might do.
Gives you
a toolkit to do your own version.
Yeah. What angle would they take with these characters? What voice would they use? And so forth. So it didn't turn out that way, but that's a way to mesh, I think.
Mm.
So that was the way I approached working on Wells as well. The Time Ships was before any of my collaborations, so that was my first experience in collaborating, in quotes, in a way.
Mm.
But I think the thing to do was look at Wells' wider work, not just the one book, but I try to get into his head. How would he think about this scene? I think these books, to some extent, are like arguments with Wells. The world did not turn out the way Wells predicted, in a sense, for reasons which could he have foreseen? Maybe not have foreseen. For example, in the Massacre of Mankind, we're following on from the Martian invasion of London. In the closing stages of the War of the Worlds, Wells as a narrator imagines what he calls a commonweal of mankind emerging from this great shock, a great unifying disaster, rather like the Second World War, but the United Nations and the European Union. However, what I think would have happened would be it's a small local disaster in England, really. It's a great existential shock, but from the point of view of Berlin or New York, it's like a volcano in Yorkshire, you know, it's a parochial event. And I think imperial ambitions, everything that led up to the First World War would more or less have happened the way it did, I think.
I mean, it's very interesting reading Massacre of Mankind to see the way you've taken that and the fact that obviously communication is difficult. Things are better now that there is Martian technology to be used. But what's very interesting in the Massacre of Mankind is the way you deal with that and the way you take the invasion more globally. I mean, you have scenes set throughout the world. This is very much an invasion of Earth rather than just of Woking. Was that something that you instinctively felt it needed to be spread out? Otherwise, you'd be retreading the same ground almost literally.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yes. It's, to me, the follow-up invasion is... It's rather like the conquistadors following Columbus. Columbus didn't have a clue what he was sailing into. He thought he was going to reach China. He had a letter for the Chinese emperor from the Queen to help the Europeans attack Islam. You know, he had no idea, and he ends up on in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Had no idea. So rather in the same way, the Wells' Martians had no real idea, it seems to me, that about conditions on Earth. You know, Earth will be difficult to observe from Mars. Like Venus is to us, Earth is inside the orbit of Mars. So you don't ever see the dark side when it's close. They'd see the cities, though, which is why they aim for London, the big shining
lights.
And Mars is a very arid world. Earth is a very wet world. So they might not have imagined phenomena like rain, you know.
Mm.
It's not an obvious outcome of the laws of physics, necessarily, rain and snow, if you've never seen it before. So the initial invasion failed in a way, but they must have learned a hell of a lot, got the information back to Mars somehow. And so the next invasion is much better equipped. They land again in England, but that's a scouting trip. And as you say, there's a global invasion as they try to figure out how to hamstring mankind, which is a danger to them. You know, world shows, gunships and so forth, knocking over Martian fighting machines. So
absolutely a sense that there's an ability to fight back.
Yep.
Limited, but and in the end, of course, as we all know, it's the germs that got them.
Yes.
And they're ready for that this time around. Much of your work is very much based on scientific accuracy. Did you find that Wells's somewhat limited science that he describes in the book managed to make it make sense?
I had to work within Wells's cosmology, which was fair enough. At the time, Lord Kelvin, who was the Brian Cox of his day, would have told you without a doubt that the sun was going to expire in 10 or 20 or 30 million years, a very short time.
Mm.
And the geologists and the biologists were arguing about that because they could see billions of years in the fossil layers. But that was the prophecy, and that was what Wells worked with. So rapidly cooling sun, Mars desiccates and freezes out. So they have to move inwards towards the sun, Earth, and then Venus. There's a hint of an invasion of Venus at the end of the War of the Worlds. So within that framework, within the science of the time, Wells is pretty accurate. And in terms of technology and the detail that he works with, it's very impressive on a kind of subliminal level. The Martians dig pits in England and make aluminium from the London clay. And the way Wells describes the Martian machines making aluminium, it's like a compressed, superpowered version of the way you actually make aluminium. That was a fairly new technology at the time.
But it was a technology he was aware of.
Yes, and but you needed the power of massive dams in America, hydroelectric power, and masses of aluminium-rich earth to do it. Wells is like a little cartoon version of the same thing. And yet it was like a very advanced extrapolation of the technology available at the time. Just the detail in the which many readers wouldn't even been aware of, I don't think.
No.
So that kind of very well-informed speculation is all the way there through Wells.
And let's move on to the largest piece of technology, of course, that most people will remember from the book, which is the war machines.
Yes.
How was it to start writing about them?
Great. Wonderful. I didn't move them on technologically very much because it seemed to me that the Martians, very ancient society, they've got their machines perfect. The strategy wasn't perfect in the way they used them on Earth in the first invasion, but the machine's pretty much perfect. So back come the fighting machines again.
Yes,
but I have a theory though about why the Martians didn't use the wheel, or you know the very obviously more artificial designs that we have. The Wells continually describes the fighting machines, whether they have passengers on board or not, as having the appearance of life. Electrically controlled musculature and so forth. They look alive, although they're clearly the things of metal. They're clearly artificial. And I think perhaps they are echoes of the vanished ecology of Mars. You know, Mars has been through a climate change, a climate collapse, not a global warming as we're going through, but a global cooling. Mm. Everything's become extinct except the Martians themselves. But maybe these are kind of memories of...
Tripedal birds or something.
Well, giraffes. I think if you looked at a pack of fighting machines moving across the Surrey landscape through half-closed eyes, it's like the Martian savannah with things like giraffes, you know, and the handling machines are like little scuttling wildebeest or something like that.
It is amazing how a book which is more than 100 years old still can evoke such imagery. And part of that is, of course, the image that it has in popular culture, whether it's from the musical or the various films or TV series. But reading it again, as I did before editing this book, it is striking how modern it still feels. Do you find that with much Wells?
Oh, certainly. Partly it was Wells's very imaginative use of the kind of literary techniques of the time. There had been invasion fictions before. It was a whole subgenre.
There's a wonderful P.G. Woodhouse invasion story about the Germans coming in and only a small troop of schoolboys managing to stop them.
Oh, yes, I've heard of that. Somebody Saves the World.
I heard of somebody, I think.
Yeah, spoof of the whole genre, But if you read some of that, some of it does read rather like, well, it's like faction, you know, very detailed and specific, and you work out the battle plans and so forth, and you get eyewitness accounts. But another thing that makes Wells very, very modern is he was a very cinematic writer. Even in 1896 or 7 when he's working on The War of the Worlds, or even The Time Machine, even earlier, he's very visual. So in The Time Machine, there's an obvious example. When the traveler goes forward through time, you see the sun shooting across the sky until it becomes a continuous band that rocks up and down with the years, and so on. Very, very visual. In The War of the Worlds, there are depictions of London as seen from above, with these black dots, which is the fleeing population, and big splashes of darkness like ink on a map, which is the black smoke of the invaders. Very cinematic. And Wells was very interested in the early cinematic experiments. So that gives it a modern feel, I think. You know, you could easily imagine taking the book as it is. Don't interpret it in any way. Just use it as a basis for a screenplay. And it would have many visual elements.
Yes.
So I think that gives it a good modern feel. And another way in which Wells anticipated the modern genre is he had an instinct for horror, I think. A lot of the touches in all his science fiction novels are very horror-like. Possibly the most memorable in War of the Worlds is hiding in the cellar, and the pseudopod of the Martian touches your boot and you can't move because you'll be dragged out to be eaten, basically.
It's that phrase, body horror, isn't it? And Invisible Man as well. And
Dr. Moreau.
Dr. Moreau, of course.
Yeah. Even The Time Machine, when the narrator's trapped in a pit with the Morlocks, the kind of feathery touch as they pour at his face and so forth. Very, very, very horror fiction.
I'm shivering in the recording booth. You use many of the characters from the original War of the Worlds, but you have a new narrator. Was that a decision that came to you quite early on, or did you at any point consider using the same narrator as the first book?
Good question. I think that evolved, I think, really. I wanted the story to be some 20 years on, 25 years on, so the narrator would be that much older. And he's also quite badly damaged by the original war.
Mm. The Scalding River.
And his kind of post-traumatic stress problems as well. So I thought he was a more interesting character to see from the outside in a way. To see, you know, from the inside, you're not quite as aware as maybe you should be of the bad condition he's in, physically at least, Scalding especially. You know, he was physically pretty damaged by the end of the book. So seeing that from the outside is a bit of a shock with the reader, I think.
I mean, he is an unreliable narrator in many ways.
Yes. But Wells made him that way. The development of War of the Worlds, if you look at the earlier drafts, some of which have been preserved in the academic archives, It's very interesting because originally the narrator, the story of the Martians was always about the same as it, you know, as in the final book. They land in Surrey, attack London, and then they're killed by the bugs. But the narrator's story is rather different in the earliest drafts. He follows the Martians, but his wife is killed by the Martians, and he falls in with a kind of a resistance group after government has collapsed, and they're bombing the Martians. So he goes up Primrose Hill with a stick of that. He's a suicide bomber, basically. He's going to blast the Martians. But Wells reworked that and wasn't happy, clearly, with the overall feel. And he makes the narrator a much more hapless character. He's much more traumatised. Even quite early in the book, he's wondering. He doesn't really know where he's going and what he's going for. Mm. He follows the Martians as if he's dazzled. And in the end, he climbs Primrose Hill to face the Martians, but in a suicidal gesture, come kill me, get it over with. But he finds us all dead. And then he goes into a three-day fugue. He has no memory.
Yes, what we know nothing about.
It's just, yeah.
It's terrible that the first thing that reminded me of was the Daleks' invasion of Earth. But so you chose to use other narrators.
Yes. Well, another character from the original, who I call Julie Elphinstone, which she's Miss Elphinstone, we know from the book. She's one of the women who encounters the narrator's brother during the flight from London. And they go through the Thunderchild incident when they reach the coast. So she was an interesting character. She was plucky. She fought back against robbers and so forth. So she was someone to take forward, I thought.
I mean, I think that is something we sometimes forget about War of the Worlds. Although we talk about the narrator, there are, in fact, other voices in there. Again, something you've replicated in The Massacre of Mankind.
Yes. I tried to, although it's like the original, it's written retrospectively. So, you know, the narrator in The War of the Worlds, he describes his own adventures, if you like, but he'll drop in a little paragraph about the latest study of the Martian machines. So it's like a historian writing a journalistic account of the war retrospectively. So that's quite a useful device. So I have Julie doing the same thing. She's a reporter. So some years after the Second War, she's writing the same kind of account, drawing in threads. And
it allows your characters to have information they wouldn't otherwise have had.
It does indeed, yes, yes. But you got the vividness of the first-person account as well.
As well as Massacre of Mankind out in January, you have other books out in 2017 as well. Should we talk a little bit about The Medusa Chronicles, which you co-wrote with Alistair Reynolds?
Yes.
The paperback of that is due out in 2017. Again, another collaboration. And again, a sequel to a classic work of science fiction. What drew you to the original Arthur C. Clarke story?
It was actually Al's idea, to be honest. That was, for him, that story was the text that got him going in terms of science fiction. When he was, I think, younger than 10, and he read a serialization magazine with gaudy illustrations, you know, in a magazine full of cutouts of submarines, that kind of thing. That got him going, and the ending is another wide-open prospect. As this dogged cyborg hero survives a descent into Jupiter, but then faces centuries of uncertainty and conflict between machine and mankind, all in a couple of sentences.
It's a wonderful last couple of lines, isn't it? Yeah. It really, really does evoke the centuries to follow. But
it is something you can do in science fiction. It's not necessarily hook for a sequel deliberately, but just leave open possibilities because the future is always open, whether or not you intend to do a sequel. Mm. But Al said he's always intended to do a sequel to that one day. And we were having an email conversation about that story. The idea just came up before you know where you are, you know it. If it's a good idea, it just explodes.
And then that's how it you came have about. A book.
Yes.
Yeah. But obviously, you collaborated with Arthur C. Clarke.
Yes.
Previously. It must have been quite different to be working on a sequel to a text from someone you had known and worked with.
Yes, although it was very helpful as well to have worked with Arthur before, you know, so knowing his style and knowing his concerns, and simply knowing his body of work was a good place to start from. So it was almost as if there were three collaborators in the room, you know, the great input of legacy of material, if you like, from Clark, and legacy ideas.
Because again, there are ideas in that book that you've drawn inspiration from other Clark stories, yep, not just Medusa, which sort of gives it a funny sense of unifying a bit of his short fiction in a funny way.
Well, he did write against a kind of common background from about 2001, the novel, through to Rendezvous with Rama and Imperial Earth in the mid-70s, so a 10-year period, roughly. He wrote about a kind of unified future history. The dates don't match up exactly, but where we'd move out into space in a big way, and there'd be a world government, so an end to poverty and want and so forth. No more arms spending, all that money would be spent on education and communications and so forth. So that was the kind of background that we used in the Medusa Chronicles. We had to make it an alternate history, as if when Clark wrote that story in 1971, as if things had diverged then. We go out to space in a big way, as opposed to making phones in a big way.
Yes.
And you get the kind of Clarkian utopia by the end of the 21st century, which is all imperiled, though, by this split with the machines.
Yes, in the dying days of 2016, that does seem quite far away.
It does,
Clarkian utopia. Yeah. And we also have Zeely Vengeance coming out later in 2017, which is your return to the Zeely sequence, which is obviously you've been writing for decades now.
Yes, thank you. Yes.
How was it to return? I know you've kept you've continued writing short stories set in that universe. How was it to return to novel length fiction?
Well, I have once before in a big way, back in the noughties with the Destiny's Child series. I like to go back to it because my first published short story was set in that universe almost accidentally. It's basically an adventure story, but I needed big offstage aliens. So humans in the relatively near future, massively powerful offstage aliens, and that's the Zeely. And it all developed from there, really. So all my earliest influences and so forth went into those early novels, which is a period where I wasn't quite in control of the material in the same way that I am now, I don't think. You know, you're less experienced, you're following your instinct much more, making guesses about what's going to work and what's not going to work. But that's all my earliest perspectives are in there. Every so often it becomes a bit enclosing, you know, you feel as if you've written yourself into a corner and the ideas are dried up. 10 years later, though, you come back and think, well, there's a paragraph in one of my early short story collections in which it says simply, for a million years, mankind waged war on the Zeely, and then there was a final defeat. And on you go to further fiction.
And That's quite a broad canvas to work on, isn't it?
It was, yeah. Looking back a little few years later, I thought, well, how on earth, well, not even on earth, how could humans like you and I fight a million-year war? We weren't even human a million years ago, you know, so that was the Destiny's Children series, for instance.
Yes.
So there's always more depths to sort of dig out of that. So it's kind of like coming home in a way. But I don't get that much fan mail, to be honest. But what I do tends to be about the Zeely series, and in particular, you never see the Zeely. They've always been off stage. You see the technology, but not the Zeely themselves.
Yes.
And Michael Poole is this engineer, near future and engineer character who becomes, through various accidents, a sort of super cosmic hero. He's remembered as a Christ-like figure in the far future.
It could happen to any of us.
It could, yeah. So wrapping up his story in the Zeely, you know, the obvious story is Michael Poole versus the Zeely. He meets the Zeely in some way. And that's what this series... I thought I'd better do it before many more decades pass. Thank you, Marcus.
Sorry.
But it seemed kind of, you know, the right time to do that.
And this is the first book of a duology. Do you feel that this will temporarily pause your association with the Zeely? Or do you think you'll have written it out by this point? Or will you keep on going?
I'll keep on going. I think the best way to approach a project is to put everything you can into it. So including these long ongoing series. Everything I've got is going to, in terms of the Zeely,
yes.
is going to go into these books now. But hopefully that tank will fill up again in a few more years' time, and I'll come back. Mm-hmm. Clark is a model for that, I think. One of his best novels, The City and the Stars.
Oh, I love that book in both versions.
Yeah. Well, you say both versions, there you are. He wrote a version at school, and I think it might have been published in some school magazine, you know, long since.
Also, you don't even know that one. I mean, this is one we don't have.
I don't think we have it, no, but, you know, it's... Maybe there is a Clarkive maintained by the
clerk
family.
Archive.
So it could be in there somewhere.
Okay. Yeah. But then, yes, Against the Fall of Night, and then...
Yeah, which he published in Astounding Magazine, or one of the science fiction magazines. Yes. Then the novel version. So I think you're looking at 30s for the schoolboy version, or earlier. 40s, or maybe early 50s for the magazine version. Late 50s for the final novel version. But he came back to it again with Greg Benford. He did a...
Yes, Beyond the Fall of Night.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but there again, he was going back to his... In his case, it was... Ola Stapledon was great. Was a great influence on Clark, and certainly on that project.
Mm.
He's going back to the primal well, you know, and revisiting and expanding and so forth.
And I think of someone like Michael Moorcock, who revises his books continuously. Every time there's a new edition, he goes back in and he makes sometimes minor, sometimes slightly bigger changes. I mean, it's very hard to say what the correct edition of any of the Elric books, for example, actually is, because it's constantly being refined and sometimes tied into his other fiction in a way which I find absolutely remarkable. But not every author perhaps has quite the body of work to be able to pull it off with. Thank you very much indeed, Steve, for talking to us about your projects for next year, and there'll be many more to come after that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
But wait, there's more. We really hope you enjoyed this interview with Stephen Baxter and Marcus Gibbs. We have an extra special treat for you. Please listen to an audio extract from Stephen's new novel, The Massacre of Mankind, read by Natalie Buscombe.
I rolled my eyes at my companions. I thought we needed to get to the point. Never mind about the Martians just now, Walter. I'm sorry to hear of your troubles. I do sympathise. You probably know I left Britain after the 11 election, when Marvin and his strutting bully boys came to power, soldiers in khaki marching behind King George's coronation coach. I would not wish to be in their hands, as you have been. But you have called for a reason. I have become desperate to get in touch, not just with you, but with Frank, Caroline. I could think of no other way but through you, Julie. I could not trace you in New York, so I asked Major Eden to bring a personal message. I hope you will see the sense of it. You have always been a girl of quality, as you said in your memoir. Sorry about that. Look, my suggestion is that you go back to England. There is still time. Take a steamer. I have the resources to pay. Gather the family, and I will make another call. Perhaps near Woking. The house I shared with Caroline is long sold, but what is it, Walter? Tell me something. So began for me an extraordinary journey. One which took me from the lobby of the world's tallest building in New York to the foot of a Martian fighting machine in London, and beyond. But for now, he would say only, I have grave news from the sky.